District of Conservation is sponsored by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, better known as CFECT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to CFECT.org. Thanks for listening to the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. Today, I am speaking with Luke Hilgeman, Executive Director of the International Order of T. Roosevelt, which is a fairly new organization in terms of its name. But as you'll learn, that this group has been active for a while. So Luke is an avid hunter, a native of Wisconsin, and he and I have actually worked in very similar circles. Funny enough, you kind of find these people whenever you work in politics and conservation, largely working for groups like Americans for Prosperity. He also led the launch of Hunter Nation, which advocates for the rights of hunters. And he also worked prior to that in the Wisconsin State Legislature, serving as a chief of staff for the majority leader in the state assembly at one point. So what does IOTR do? You guys have probably seen the name float around. They've had several banquets and events bringing in some of the who's who in the conservation world. And they've been making a splash, especially to fight for the right to hunt and fish, to promote this cherished tradition and lifestyle and enshrine it into state constitutions. And this has been a movement to enshrine the right to hunt and fish for a while. Actually, if you don't know, Vermont was the first state to do it, like in the 1700s. Then the momentum started to build in the 80s, 90s, if I'm not mistaken. And now 23 states have the safeguard of hunting, fishing. Some have a variation of it to include trapping and also foraging. But IOTR, as their mission statement reads, they aim to protect the North American model of wildlife conservation that is tied to their namesake's legacy, Theodore Roosevelt. They will stand up against bad actors to protect our hunting heritage and at-risk wildlife. Obviously, their chief work is right to hunt and fish amendments, but they also do some other stuff in protecting the greater sage grouse. I know there's a huge debate over that. And then also expanding accessibility, the breakdown of barriers to the great outdoors. So they do a lot and they're worth paying attention to. And Luke and I had a great conversation. So I think you all are really going to enjoy what he has to say. And we also round out the conversation about hunting voter apathy. Not so much about a partisan discussion, but we really dive deep into why is there so much hunter apathy, even though their rights are on the line or the hunting heritage is on the line. We had a wide-ranging conversation that I think you will enjoy. Luke is going to take it away from here. Luke, it's good to have you on the podcast. Good to connect finally. Thanks for coming on.
It's so great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
What is your background? Because you and I have some similar involvement in politics and you also have an interest in hunting, but could you share your background?
You bet. So I've been in the political grassroots policy space for about the last 20 years of my life. Started as a legislative aide in the Wisconsin State Capitol. Worked there for about a decade and then had the opportunity to take over operations of the Wisconsin State Chapter of Americans for Prosperity. AFP fights for economic liberty and freedom. I've been a lifelong conservative and it's what I've, modeled myself after. So had a chance to run that chapter. And then after the Scott Walker recalls and everything that went into that fight, I had an opportunity to actually become the national CEO of Americans for Prosperity. And moved my family from Wisconsin to Virginia and built out a grassroots infrastructure there, which was in 36 different states, all focused on trying to connect people with the facts that freedom works. And, we had almost 700 staff, about $100 million a year operating budget. But for a Wisconsin boy, my wife was very insistent that when we took that opportunity, we were not going to stay in Washington forever. And so we took the opportunity to move back to Wisconsin, where we're both from, and raise our kids where we were raised about 7 years ago. And since that time, I've been in the hunting advocacy space. I grew up on a small farm in north central Wisconsin, following my dad and uncles into the woods since I was a little boy. And hunting and fishing is, it's in my blood. It's what we do for fun with our family. It's also something that's part of our heritage. And carrying on those traditions with my family is really important to me. But seeing what's happened with the decline in not only hunter numbers over the last decade, but also too in the threats that we see coming at these sports faster than we can try and address them, made me want to get into the fight and protect and preserve hunting and everything that goes around conservation, fishing as well, for the last 4 or 5 years of my life now. So that's my background. I'm a grassroots political guy who sees himself as a hunter first. And now I'm running an organization that I think is making a significant impact at preserving and protecting these traditions and passing them on to the next generation.
Your organization, IOTR, is a young organization, but you guys have already had an impact from what I've been observing and friends of mine who've worked very closely with you guys. So explain what IOTR does, what your mission statement is, and what some of your immediate goals are.
Yeah, so IOTR has actually been around since 1975, but we've gone through some rebranding here under our new chairman, Wes Bates. And now we are really focused on being the leading voice at protecting fishing and hunting rights across the country, because we've seen these threats that I was talking about earlier, where there are states that are considering ballot initiatives to criminalize catching a fish, harvesting wild game, and really just overriding 150 years of a successful conservation model that was built here by our namesake, Teddy Roosevelt. So we are in the fight. We like to say that we are in the arena, fighting every day to protect and preserve hunting and fishing so that these traditions can truly be passed on to the next generation of Americans. So again, we're an organization that's been around for a long time, but we're a granting organization, and now we are a fighting organization. We're on the front lines taking this fight to the opposition, and we intend to win.
Well, I wasn't aware that it had a previous name, so my apologies there, because it seemed like a new organization when former director Skip with Giacometto was leading the organization. But okay, thank you for the clarification. But besides the right to hunt fish, which I'll have you go more into, are you guys also following what's happening with the hijacking of game commissions as well? Is that also something on your radar?
Absolutely. And that's one thing that's very troubling. One of our strategic partners, the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, as well as SCI, have been leading up the charge there. We're involved in those fights. We see that as a trend that needs to be stopped. We can't continue to cede ground to people who don't hunt and fish, who don't understand the importance of the North American model and why the user pay systems work so well, to allow them to be in positions of power when it comes to dictating season structure, what we can and can't hunt, what we can and can't manage. And we think that's a troubling trend that also needs to be addressed.
23 states, to my knowledge, have right to hunt and fish amendments. I saw that this legislative session, your organization, I think more so through your C4 arm or the other vertical outside of the nonprofit, was working very heavily to push right to hunt fish amendments in several states. So where were you guys working? What's the movement that has happened, or lack thereof movement?
Yeah, so again, this is our top legislative priority through our C4 arm, as you said, our advocacy arm, T. Roosevelt Action. We obviously had a significant victory in Florida, getting that passed there 154-1. And it's been organic now with these other states coming to us and saying, well, we don't have it and we want to. So we've been working very hard in states like Ohio, South Dakota, Iowa, West Virginia, and Missouri are the next tier of states that we've been working in. We also think we have a shot to get it done in Arizona as well, where while we were just in Scottsdale for our annual meeting, I met with a number of top outdoor leaders, and they're the one state that has actually had it on the ballot and it failed. And so they think that they have a chance now because of some of the threats that we've seen to hunting and fishing in the West to put this back up to the voters of Arizona and hopefully get it passed and put into forever protection is the way that I look at this. By putting it into the state constitution, people ask me, well, so what? What's that going to do? And I just go back to what I did here in the state of Wisconsin as a personal citizen, because I have a constitutional right to hunt. I was able to sue the state of Wisconsin as an individual citizen because they blocked our wolf hunting season from taking hold, from moving forward. And so I actually sued the state of Wisconsin, not only on statutory grounds, but also on constitutional grounds, and won on both accords. And within 72 hours, our Department of Natural Resources had to open our wolf hunting season. And we killed 218 wolves in 72 hours, even though there was only supposed to be 1,000 of those animals on the landscape. And again, we're not an organization that believes that we should kill all of these predators, because again, we think they're an important part of the ecosystem. But like all wild populations, they need to be responsibly managed, just like we do with our deer, our elk, our turkeys, and other species.
I remember putting some signage to the Ohio resolution. What's the status with that one? And did anything happen in West Virginia and some of the other states you guys are working on, or not so much movement?
Yep. So Ohio is queued up. We have it. It's waiting for passage in the House. So there's been some turmoil there politically in the state House with the speaker, who's more of a moderate than I am. But he, you know, has been a little bit reluctant to put this bill on the floor, even though we know that we've done polling there with the U.S. Sportsmen's Alliance that shows if this gets to the ballot, 76% support amongst Ohio residents and voters to pass a constitutional right to hunt and fish in Ohio. So we are going to continue to light a fire under the speaker in Ohio and try and get a vote on this, because, again, we think it's primed to pass in a state like Ohio, which has, you know, tremendous support from people of all political beliefs and backgrounds. And that's where it's at in Ohio. West Virginia, they had a hearing on their bill, and they're kind of, I think, in a more slower pace than we would like to see. But again, I think as soon as we get this passed in states like Florida and then pass it through later this fall, when I think it's going to pass with 60% plus that we need to get it into the Constitution, our goal is to create a national movement to get as many states as we can to adopt a constitutional right to hunt and fish. We think that number is somewhere 35 plus states that have the opportunity and the ability to do that.
That's an ambitious goal. I hope so, because it is extremely important, especially to take these measures preemptively. Here in Virginia, where I live, we've had a right to hunt and fish amendment for at least a decade, I think a little longer than that. So at least a decade, we've had these protections here since I've moved here. I know that that's been the fact. But I think a lot of people, when they hear, like, why do I need this right to hunt and fish amendment, they don't understand that it is done preemptively because of the attacks being waged on both hunting and fishing that are transpiring largely out west, as you said, and a little bit kind of creeping into, I would say, the southeast a little bit, but you definitely see it in the northeast. The northeast is center ground, same with the west, but the northeast, I see anything above the Mason-Dixon line, like white Vermont is especially being targeted. New York is always targeted. They try to do it in New Hampshire. They don't succeed there right now, thankfully. And it's just, I think people are starting to wake up and see that as they chip away slowly at certain forms of hunting, it eventually reaches very popular forms of hunting, and then they don't know what to do.
That's exactly right. And you can look at the opposition, right? Where is HSUS, the Coyote Project, and others, where are they devoting their resources and their efforts to try and ban some form of hunting? It's in states that don't have a constitutional right to hunt and fish. So if they're directing their resources there, we need to do everything we can in the states that currently don't have it to get it passed as quickly as possible, as setting up a firewall against some of the radical ideas that they're trying to push.
Yeah, I think of Colorado. It comes top to mind this year. It feels like this is the year that they're going to be targeted, and we'll see what happens and transpires. And hopefully the voters there will be able to stave off attempts to restrict predator management or big game management in the form of some of the bigger cats. But the language that, I don't know if you've been watching that battle very closely. I had one of the spokespeople of a group fighting to protect the hunting heritage there on my podcast recently, but he said that the language they want to adopt under the guise of combating so-called trophy hunting, it would extend to actually small game hunting and even non-controversial forms of hunting. And they said it's very concerning because it would be statutory language that could be applied outside of Colorado too. So it is extremely important to know what is happening in the states and ensuring that those safeguards and protections are there preemptively before, you know, any changes that happen in your state legislature going from a pro-hunting majority to a not pro-hunting majority. It happens very quickly. Colorado, I think, is a recent example of that. Same with Washington State.
Without a doubt. And then you hit it. You hit the nail right on the head there, right? As hunters and people who love the outdoors, we have to be eternally vigilant to see these threats coming and call them out when they do. You know, the other thing I think that hunters, and especially if hunters and anglers and trappers and the folks who pay for the conservation in America could unite, these types of threats would stand no chance. Unfortunately, we find really good ways to divide ourselves more often than not, and instead of being a united voice against these types of threats. So I love to see what they're doing in Colorado. We've been closely following that one as well, and are hopeful that they can defeat that ridiculous policy before it takes hold and starts moving its way eastward.
When you look at how the residents of Colorado voted very narrowly to reintroduce wolves against the recommendations of people on the ground at Ballot Box Biology, I want to be hopeful that they will have learned their lesson and not repeat that, or maybe greater education will have taken place before this election going on in November. But it scares me a little bit that it narrowly passed. So I'm hoping they're more organized on it. It seems like they are a lot more organized now to prevent and stave off that attempt from happening whenever they finalize the ballot language. But maybe it won't be finalized, who knows, and maybe it won't go on the ballot. But they, I think, are very vigilant, the antis, in terms of repackaging that trophy language and then getting it on the ballot. I think they have like a deadline sometime this summer. So they have some time, oddly enough. But yes, they're very clever in terms of how they're trying to insert it. And then people don't realize it until after the fact when it's voted on, even narrowly, like it was with the Wolf case.
Agreed.
During your most recent conference in Scottsdale, Arizona, your organization announced a very cool partnership with the Cabela Family Foundation to sponsor their Hard Truths of Conservation program on the History Channel, which I actually watch, and I love watching that program. It's a great, great program. Dan Cabela is an excellent host. He goes all over the country for those who don't watch it. And it really narrows down to and discusses the hard truths of conservation in a very tasteful, respectful way. He involves a lot of different stakeholders. So speak to this partnership, what you guys hope to accomplish with it, and what are the long-term goals of working with the Cabela Family Foundation?
Yeah, first of all, we were just tremendously honored to be in a partnership with Dan Cabela and the Cabela's family. When you look at who has done more for conservation in the last 50 years in this country, it's hard. You're hard pressed to find another family who has done as much as the Cabela's family has. And so we're honored to be in this partnership with them. What we saw in this is the opportunity to get in front of millions of Americans who we see as the non-hunting public. Dan's program airs on the History Channel. It's one that he reached 8.3 million viewers here in this last season. And he's talking to a large percentage of people who don't hunt and fish, who haven't heard about conservation. And the way that he portrays it, I think, is brilliant. He talks about every aspect of it and how our dollars are the ones that are allowing for record herds, record flocks, and supporting communities across not only North America, but the globe with our hunter dollars. And so we are honored to be in this partnership with them. We think that, it's not only going to put our message out there for millions of people to see, but we are really excited about what we think can be done on the project side with conservation in America, that we share their vision for bringing back huntable species of wild game all across North America. And that's the other part of the partnership, is we're going to be 50-50 financial partners with the Cabela's Family Foundation to put our conservation dollars to work, to make sure that we are out there doing everything we can to put more game on the dirt and really have an opportunity to show why hunting is truly conservation in America.
If individuals or organizations are listening to us chat and they're researching your organization, do you want your organization to receive certain tips or be solicited, like different ideas or projects outside of your partnership with Cabela's, the Cabela Family Foundation, to help with certain projects? Are you guys looking for other kind of hunting adjacent, fishing adjacent projects to be involved in as well?
Absolutely. I mean, we're looking for ideas from across North America. Our specific focus, again, we know that hunting, fishing, and conservation is a global issue. But as our chairman, Wes Bates, has told us multiple times, that if we don't save these traditions here in America, they're not going to exist outside. And so that's our focus, is anything that we can do to help bring back huntable species or, you know, bring back more fish into our streams and lakes. That's something that we're definitely interested in doing. Folks can go to our website at www.iotr.org. There's an info button there that you can click, and please send us those ideas, because, again, we're looking at them through the lens of the Cabela's family and what we can do together. And I think we can do a heck of a lot of good.
Luke, was there anything else you wanted to touch upon as we round out our conversation? I think you were wanting to talk about hunter apathy at the ballot box.
Yeah, Gabby, that's one of the most troubling trends that we see, not only in states like Florida, but all across the country. We have the data that proves out that less than half of American hunters are voting on a regular basis. We're the first ones to be out there and you know, complain when our rights are starting to be taken away. And unfortunately, too many of us are sitting it out when it comes to picking the people who lead these conversations at every level of government. So I think it's incumbent on us, all of us as hunters, outdoorsmen, conservationists, people who believe in the model that we built, that we are regular participants in the voting process. And all you got to do is go and talk to a few of your buddies. I've done this myself. My hunting camp, I thought everybody was a regular voter. Sat down, started talking to them, actually pulled the data on a number of them and was blown away that less than half of my own hunting camp had voted on a regular basis. So we have to do more as hunters and anglers and conservationists to make sure that we are out there participating at the level we need to protect our pastimes before they're taken away.
What would you attribute the apathy to lack of hunter voting? Because I want to know what explains it, because does it conflict with hunting season? I've heard that's often an argument. Maybe they're disillusioned by the candidate selection, or maybe they don't see that hunting's on the ballot, so they forego voting altogether. What is your theory behind that?
You hit all three of them, and we've actually pulled this and we've focus grouped it. And number one concern that comes from hunters as to why they don't vote is they don't believe that politicians care about people like them. And what I immediately retort back is you don't give them a reason to if you don't participate. We still live in a republic that allows people, one citizen can make a difference by standing up and speaking out. And that's what we need to do across the board. We see these threats like we see in Oregon and Colorado and other places. We better unite and we better speak out loudly, because otherwise our traditions as we know them will be gone before the next generation.
And what is the percentage of hunters that don't vote? What have you seen?
Over 50%. So nationally, again, depending on whose numbers you use, 13 to 15 million hunters, there's 7.5 million of them that are sitting it out. From sea to shining sea. I wish that this was a trend that was only isolated to a few states, but every state that we've pulled it in, that's the kind of participation we see. And it's really troubling.
It really is. And I'm glad you guys are paying attention to that. And we'll sound the alarm here on this podcast to alert people to vote the right, you know, vote to hunt and et cetera, yeah. Et cetera, because you will lose those opportunities. I always tell people, it is important to vote for president. It is important to vote, you know, for senators too, but people forget and neglect that the governor that you have in your state is extremely important, because they appoint all those commissioners.
Amen.
And board appointees. Amen. And if you're not caring who that person is, if they're pro hunting, pro fishing, and then you wake up to find out one day that you have someone who's very antagonistic to that. I think of Washington State, Jay Inslee, and what he's doing and stacking the boards with extremists, animal rights extremists. Same in Colorado, Jared Polis doing the same thing. He comes off a little more moderate than Jay Inslee, but he has succeeded in putting in the appropriate people to undermine true conservation efforts. We see that are all across the board in Colorado and in many other states. California is now kind of reaping what they sow, stacking the commissions across, you know, from Jerry Brown coming back for his third and fourth terms, and then Gavin Newsom installing anti-hunting, anti-fishing commissioners. Although I think there was someone who was a little more amenable to our lifestyle in California, just nominated and put back onto the board because they're atrophying money and supporters and licenses. So maybe they're having a little course correction there. But Luke, everyone who is curious to learn about IOTR and to get involved, kind of what we've been talking about, you alluded to the website. Is there any place else that they can go to? My listeners can go to social media, contact you. Please dispense
where
people can do that.
Absolutely. Follow us on all of the social media feeds. Again, we have rebranded ourselves. We are out there in the arena fighting every day. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. And we just need more people following us, being a part of what we're doing. We are going to launch in a big way our C4 advocacy arm here, probably before the end of the year. And we will have a membership model that we'll build out there as well. So if people believe in the legacy of Teddy Roosevelt and protecting and defending the outdoor heritage that we've built here in America for the last 150 years, they will definitely want to check out T. Roosevelt Action and become a member of that organization as soon as we get that stood up later this year.
When that information becomes available, let me know. I will share it around. Maybe we can revisit again with the launch of that action center. And any way we can be of help, please let me know. And it's been very nice to chat with you, Luke. I hope we can interact in person sometime soon.
Very much appreciate your time. And thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners, and we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I'm all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.